The Bleacher Report app is your destination for sports. Right now, the NBA is heating up, March Madness is here, and MLB is almost back. Every day there's a new headline, a new highlight, a new moment you've got to see for yourself. That's why I stay locked in with the Bleacher Report app. For me, it's about staying connected to my sports. I can follow the teams I care about, get real-time scores, breaking news, and highlights all in one place. Download the Bleacher Report app today so you never miss a moment.
Welcome to The Tower, a podcast that explores the films that took the rulebook, doused it in gasoline, and lit a match. The Tower tarot card represents chaos and the upheaval of old forms. And here, I will focus on films that did just that for my brilliant guests. The films that changed them forever are films that belong in The Tower. In each episode, I interview visionaries in cinema, from directors to festival programmers, from actors to writers, and we explore their favorite paradigm-shifting films. The fire's burning. Come dance with us in the flames. Welcome to The Tower. Today, on this episode, I have the wonderful Larry Fessenden on as my guest. Larry is an actor, a filmmaker, an all-around huge voice in cinema, in horror cinema, and I'm thrilled to welcome him today. Hi, Larry.
Hey, Emily. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. So for listeners who might not know who you are, just give them a sense of who you are.
I'm a filmmaker. In my mind, I'm primarily a film writer and director, but I'm mostly known for starting a company called Glass Eye Picks as far back as 1985. And it's turned into a little shop, comes out of New York City, where we make independent movies in an independent-minded way. That often means low budgets. And as a result, I usually work with first-time and second-time directors. And over time, I've built a reputation for mentoring a lot of the great voices in horror, for example, Ty West, Jim Mickle. I've also worked with people like Kelly Reichert. It's really just a community of New York filmmakers, and we've built a nice, you know, underground reputation. And, you know, we were there since the 90s. I made a film called Habit, which is a vampire movie. Though I didn't advertise it that way at first, because it's really a day in the life of an alcoholic dude living in New York City in the 90s, and he encounters a woman and starts to be convinced she's a vampire. And then I went on to tell stories like Wendigo, and so they're sort of a humanist, social realism-based movies that show great affection for horror. I made a movie called Depraved, which is a Frankenstein story. Blackout is a werewolf movie. And I've acted in lots and lots of movies. I usually get killed within the first 2 minutes of my arrival on screen. So but that's who I am.
And honestly, Habit is just, it's one of my favorite genre horror films of all time. And it was such a pleasure to see it. I think it was last year it played Brooklyn Horror.
Oh yeah, on the screen. It was really sweet. And I got a little award, which was a VHS with a great cover that said, I don't quite remember what, good on you. But it was fun to screen it again. And Brooklyn Horror is really, it's been fun to watch that grow. It's now a real touchstone in the horror. You know, the horror film festivals are a very special experience. And Brooklyn Horror has become one of the great ones.
I couldn't agree more. And I think this year is their 10th year, which is really exciting.
So cool, because I remember when it started and I thought, oh guys, I don't know if this is going to work out. You know, you're trying to be Fantasia, you're trying to be Sitges or something, but actually it's really got a great vibe, and it's really come into its own. It's an honor to be in that festival, so it was nice to be feted.
and celebrated as you should be. Well, I love the film that you picked for today for your Tower film. And I was trying to guess what you would pick just because you have such a deep cinematic knowledge. You're an actor. So I was like, okay, maybe he would go toward something simple and just beautifully acted. Or you're also a brilliant filmmaker, which is how I mostly think of you. And this just seemed kind of perfectly foundational and fitting for Larry Fessenden, the filmmaker. And it was really moving to see this film again. So why don't you tell the audience what your Tower film is?
Well, I appreciate that you haven't named it yet. So we'll continue the suspense with my, I just want to describe to the audience the horror of receiving the prompt from you, which is, you know, what movie made you want to make movies? What movie made you think you could direct? I mean, this is all, I'm the type of person, you know, I love that expression, I contain multitudes. I mean, there's so many things that led me to make the movies the way I make them. I mentioned they're social realists. So, and of course, I have a deep love of horror, which came from my youth. I was a kid that felt like an outsider. I mean, I have two older brothers. I don't know. It's actually, you know, it's the job of the psychoanalyst to figure out why one is what one is. But I always liked, I loved sharks and dinosaurs and soon enough monsters. And I think it was just a deep sensitivity. But then you grow up and you sort of, you find that anger that comes with adolescence. And so then there's that. So what I'm getting at is that as a youth, I watched, I'm an old dude now. So I grew up watching TV. That's where I saw most of the movies. And then I would go to the movies because I grew up in New York. Mm-hmm. So I'd see, you know, first run pictures, but I mostly associate cinema with watching old black and white movies on TV. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's why I chose what I chose, because it's very, as you say, foundational. And the movie is Frankenstein, 1931, with Boris Karloff. And I think I just wanted to, in a way, start at the beginning, like the image of that monster with the flat head and the bolts, which has become, you know, such a cliche, resonates with me. And he really, that creature and that performance and the starkness of the film that really speak to, I think, the whole genre of horror, because he is both incredibly scary in the design and sort of his role in the movie, but he's also deeply sympathetic. And this is how I take in horror. I'm both, I recoil from it, but I'm also, I reach to it with a feeling of empathy. And, you know, I think that's how I relate to it. And so I just thought Frankenstein was a way to talk about movies. I mean, what happened is that I loved those old black and white movies. I could have easily said Wolfman. I could have maybe said The Creature from the Black Lagoon. Notice that each of those monsters they're vulnerable. They're in a story where they're sort of othered and they're struggling with a curse in the case of the werewolf, or the why am I here in the case of Frankenstein, or get the fuck out of my lake in the case of The Creature. And, you know, also in a way the humans are really the problem, the source of the horror, you know, and obviously Dr. Frankenstein is the problem character in that movie as he brings this unwitting creature to life. Mm. And so on. So not to just ramble on, but I just wanted to say, I could easily have said my Tower film was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you see? So I just want to say that I actually, while horror is my foundation, then I, you know, Taxi Driver and Cuckoo's Nest and a lot of the 70s movies. And that's where it became essential. And, you know, then I followed the careers of Jack Nicholson and Robert De Niro and Hoffman and Pacino and so on. So it's been a long journey. And that's what I bring to the horror genre, which is still, I want to see a werewolf in a movie. I want to see a Frankenstein design. I want to see a creature effect, you know, a Godzilla or a King Kong. King Kong was the first movie I remember seeing. And in a way, that could have been my foundational film as well. So on it goes. I guess the answer is I don't have one. I have so many.
I know. It's a really cruel ask.
It is a cruel. It's a cruel podcast.
And just before we properly dive in, I just wanted to ask, like, you've mentioned so many classic monsters, and what makes a creature a monster to you? Thinking about all of these films, what makes someone a monster? Is it the way that others treat them? Is it the design of them? What's the DNA of a monster? Why is something a monster to you?
I think in the end, well, first of all, once again, talk about not being able to pin me down. The thing is that my next film is literally asked that question. So I don't want to talk about it. In fact, I'm sort of tickled at the idea of not doing any talking about the new movie, although I realize that's probably going to be impossible because I'm such a chatterbox when you get me started. But in any case, I do think that's a fundamental question that I've been asking all along. And, you know, for example, Inhabit, I really only use the word vampire once, and it's so obvious he's an alcoholic. And so you realize, you know, there's the whole idea of what are your demons? So if you're the victim of a monster, it's very often becomes... So the answer is... A monster is a metaphor, and metaphor is a way we talk about so many things, and that's what's kind of wonderful. As I said, Frankenstein, the character of the monster, is both a victim of someone else's ambition and madness and scientific, desire to play God and experimentation, all of that. So he's a victim in that he's been brought to life. But then that's true of all of us, you see. So why are we here? And that becomes this is a metaphor. And then in the case of Frankenstein's monster, he is also reviled because he looks scary. And therefore, he is any one of us who've ever felt judged or misunderstood. So there again, but you know, you actually said it in your question. The other thing about a monster is the design of it. It's literally pop art. And this is why I did choose Frankenstein. I think it's one of the great pop art images ever created by Jack Pierce, of course, the makeup man who did all the Universal monsters and then and died in poverty. So there you go. But Jack Pierce was a very precise, I think, extremely difficult dude, but he was a true artist. And he's been celebrated. It's not any kind of a tragedy. He designed all the monsters, although, of course, the creature from the Black Lagoon was designed by Millicent. What was her name? Millicent Patrick? Anyway, by a woman, which is fantastic. And she became very revered. And the Westmore family, which was the makeup giants at that time in the 50s, kind of tried to suppress her fame. So blah, blah, blah. There you go. A feminist story for you. Most of the previous monsters were designed by Jack Pierce, including the Bride of Frankenstein. And that it's just there's something tragic and singular about the design. We've talked about, I've said, you know, metaphor, it speaks, it's a way of talking about the human condition without being specific and telling, you know, a maudlin drama about being an outsider. I mean, you know, obviously you can do that, and there's plenty of good movies in that department, but I prefer something that is more expressionistic. And then so it's the role of the monster, and then it's the design, and that combination is thrilling. The other thing is that I came to horror also through comics and through so a lot of the creatures that I love, I also was engaged with them through comic books. There's an artist named Mike Ploog. There's obviously Bernie Wrightson. These are great pictorialists of the very same creature. So I guess, again, I'm talking about all the different influences that combine to make me obsessed with this kind of imagery.
No, I love that. Yeah, I completely agree. I find dramas that, in a maudlin way, as you said, go directly. No. I mean, some of them certainly, but it's almost like you're going at the human condition and the idea of otherness. It's like an eclipse, right? You can't look right at it. You need to look to a representation of it, you know, the piece of paper or, you know, how you're supposed to look at the eclipse. You're not going directly at, like, this is a film about the human condition. This is, and in the case of Frankenstein, this is about God and man playing God and ambition. The director, James Whale, is not like outright just saying that, you know, in a kind of blunt way. He's going beside that. And in doing that, we as the audience get to take very personal experiences from our own lives and really apply it. And it just seems to ring even more true because we're not being preached to.
I love that. That's exactly my feeling about the genre in general. And monster movies in particular, is that they are standing for something. And so it's a bigger umbrella. This is why metaphors are cool, because they're a big umbrella. They speak to you if you're gay, if you're, if you're out, you know, somehow, if not feeling at home. Well, I guess racism, you know, if you're not at home in your community, if you're reviled, if you're falsely accused, if you're different, if you're eccentric, maybe even if you're an artist in a certain kind of community that won't tolerate that. All of these things. The point is that it's an umbrella for you to experience, to empathize with a story without a direct connection to the character. I guess if you're perceived as ugly, you know, in other words, it speaks for all of us. And let's face it, all the things I've listed are specific things, but we all feel that in one way or another. We feel like we're not the favorite person in the class and all of this growing up. It's the natural state of being human. And so I think horror is able to address that without being so literal that it becomes an after-school special. And yet, So you have all of that. In other words, people can identify. Or, you know, the other thing is that we're speaking a little bit. Obviously, some horror movies, the monsters are terrifying. And there you have this idea of loss of control and the sheer oppressive nature, reality of nature and the sort of the randomness of disease, the randomness of a natural disaster, the horror of a fire, you know, a car accident. So let's not say that horror is only this warm blanket to make you feel good if you're feeling, sad for yourself. It's also addressing, you know, what I would say the elephant in the room is. It's a way of talking about death and misdeed and indeed, you know, the shock of a sudden axe murderer coming into your home. So all the things that we also live with the fear of, it's a way of confronting it. And, you know, I've never been a gore hound, so I'm not really saying that gore is cathartic, but it is part of the conversation. You know, life is scary. That's the other thing. My joke is I used to say I want to make horror movies so people can feel how I feel all the time, which is I'm just naturally prone to see things in terms of the frightening aspect. Mm. And that's just a personality trait. I was not abused as a child. I had a lovely childhood, I suppose, relatively. But I think you can also access all that if you're very sensitive and you kind of realize life is very precious and it's not a guarantee. You could fall down those stairs. You could trip with that knife. And indeed, there's some bad folks out there and they could come and get you. Or so could a bear. In fact, oh my God, I'm going to go hide under the bed. That's the world. You know, I always joke. People say, Larry, you should make comedies. You're so silly. And I'm like, yeah, but as soon as I sit down at the page, it gets dark.
I mean, we have to get the demons out, I think.
Exactly. And we have to call out. Everybody acts like everything's fine. No, it's not. So I want to just show people. It's scary, the whole thing. And that's also supposed to be a comfort. You know, we share that. I think people who like horror, it's because they want this. Well, it's a very strong community, even if there's infighting. But the bottom line is we all sort of understand that this needs to, we need to get this out. And we need to commune together in these scary stories.
So today we're talking about Frankenstein, 1931, directed by James Whale. The synopsis is Dr. Henry Frankenstein is obsessed with assembling a living being from parts of several exhumed corpses. And off we go. I mean, it's, I have to say, Larry, I believe I've seen all of this film before. I've certainly seen it in parts. But this was the first time I really sat down and watched it, especially since becoming a filmmaker. And I was just so taken by the German expressionist sets, the lighting, the huge shadows cast on these grand, cruel landscapes, the physical journey that we go through. And honestly, the acting is so superb. And it's oddly really modern feeling. And I know it's a bit stilted because the story they're telling is quite grand. It's a bit Shakespearean, what we're going through. But I mean, the lead here, other than Boris Karloff, who is unbelievable, and we can totally get into him, but Colin Clive, who plays Henry Frankenstein, I was just transfixed to this guy the entire time. I mean, what are kind of your initial overall topographical thoughts of this film?
So, you know, a very, very quick history. Obviously, this is a book written in 1818 by an 18-year-old Mary Shelley. So that also haunts the spectacularness of the property itself. I really believe she created at that age, in that incredibly chauvinistic world, a modern myth. I mean, and as you probably know, the original book is called Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus. So she very much was calling back to the very essence of human storytelling. You know, Prometheus stole fire from the gods and then was punished forevermore. Anyway, so there you have this. And they had done a play of it. And then what happened is in the 30s, they made Dracula with Bela Lugosi, and it was a huge hit. And they were like, we've got to find something else. What is there? Oh, there's Frankenstein. And they did hire, they wanted Lugosi to play the monster. He refused because there was too much makeup and he thought it was disrespectful and a silly part. And James Whale found Boris Karloff in a commissary at the Universal Studios. Karloff was already, I think, 40, and he had been in dozens and dozens and dozens of movies. So that's a beautiful story. James Whale. So I'm just trying to set the scene. You know, World War One had ended and people were coming back disfigured and deformed. That was considered the first modern war, where the weaponry would just tear you apart, but there was enough science that people would survive. And so there was this sort of haunted vibe in the streets of America and Europe, of course, of these disfigured characters. So when we speak about otherness, you know, the creature also sort of represented that really depraved history that was very fresh in people's minds of deformity and so on. So 1931, so the movie, James Whale gets the project. He got the project, he found Karloff, and he had worked with Colin Clive before. Now, what's fascinating is that, or sort of vaguely charming and tragic, I suppose, is I think Colin Clive, well, I know he was a terrible alcoholic and he had his own demons, and he was a very flowery character. I think he was gay, maybe not. I don't want to pigeonhole him, but obviously, or in any case, James Whale was, and I think he was out, which is kind of wonderful at the time. And But so anyway, so these were some of the elements, and that's where you really see great directing is obviously putting a piece together. It's not just, you know, your camera shots like a Hitchcock kind of way of talking about directing. So, I mean, I like that you mentioned the sets, and it's you know, it, of course, you're watching an old movie. It's important. You seem to be watching a series of cliches, but the point is these cliches came from something, and it's probably Frankenstein. Yeah. For example, the lab, the little lightning bolts going from one apparatus to another. All of that was invented for this movie, you know, even the beakers and then carrying the monster up. The book is very unspecific about how the creature was created. So this film, 1931, proposed the idea of the electricity. All the things that are literally on Saturday morning cartoons now were invented for this movie. Now, I just want to speak briefly about why. So most people, or a lot of people, say that Bride of Frankenstein, made in 1935 with the same director and, thank goodness, the same basic cast, as well as the addition of Elsa Lanchester as the bride. Most people, or a lot of people, it's commonly said that that's a better film. It's even more operatic. It's more beautifully designed. Everything more. I much prefer Frankenstein. It feels more punk rock. It feels much more spare than the following movie, which is its own treasure. But in a way, it got too broad for my taste. And at least comparing the two, I prefer the starkness of Frankenstein. And you're absolutely right. It is that German design.
Expressionism.
Expression,
yeah.
That we saw in, for example, almost a Frankenstein type movie, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, with literally cantilevered angles, but it's also the long shadows, everything that we borrowed from the Germans. And obviously Nosferatu, 1922, had also been made. So I think James Whale was aware of all of that. So we start in a graveyard, beautiful low angle shot with this very, almost feels like you're looking at a stage production, and they are unburying the coffin, and they pull out the corpse, and Colin Clive gets right to it. And he says something like, you know, we're going to bring this to life. And the other cliche that everybody would chuckle at, but once again, started here, is the literally the hunchback assistant, played by Dwight Frye. He's also a spectacular performance.
Yeah. And you are correct. I just looked it up. Yeah.
Yeah. So he is so wonderful as the hunchback, who's not, there's something funny about it. He's not named Igor. Igor came in later, or maybe he is. All to be researched.
Fritz,
exactly. Yeah. Well, that's, yeah, so he's Fritz. Anyway, and that whole cliche persists. And then, and you know, in the movie, I mean, look, the movie is still, has some absurdities, but so he steals he goes to get the brain for the Frankenstein monster, and there's a little jump scare where he runs into a skeleton that's hanging in the scientific room, and you know, all of this kind of slightly campy stuff. James Whale definitely had a sense of humor and knew what he was getting on about. And then, so because of the skeleton scare, he drops the brain that he was tasked with getting, and then he picks up another brain that literally says abnormal. So it's a criminal brain. And, you know, this was all been made wonderful fun of in the fantastic movie Young Frankenstein, which I'll tell you, a lot of people encounter this whole Frankenstein story through that movie. I mean, at least modern people, they've probably seen Young Frankenstein and not necessarily seen this movie. But it's so lovely portrayed that you do, in fact, get the same story, even though there's more chuckles.
Yeah, I totally agree. Just what you said, that opening graveyard scene is so enthralling and arresting. And then, yeah, we're in this classroom with the you know, the lectures going on, and it's all like, very, very nice. We're all academic here. You know, lights go off. It's night. And the, you know, the skeleton is casting this gigantic shadow on the wall, and in comes Fritz, and he's like, okay, I gotta get a brain. And, so there's literally normal brain and abnormal brain, on the desk there. And I feel like if my brain was in a jar, I would probably be the latter. But yeah, he picks up normal brain.
Then there's Bennett's brain.
Oh God, don't do that. But he's just like, I guess this will do. And so he takes the abnormal brain and scurries out of there. It's just, Young Frankenstein is such a classic. And actually, I may just have to rewatch that again after talking to you about this. It's so hilarious.
Well, the line is, he's like, well, whose brain was it? And he goes, abnormal. so silly, but so fun. Wait, now, but you inspired me. You see, as you described it, I'm actually picturing every shot. So the beginning, Fritz is on top of a gallows with this knife in his mouth, and he's inching across the wood to cut down the corpse. So there's that. And that's the idea that it's a fresh corpse. And I think that's what Colin Clive is actually talking about. He's like, it's still, you know, it's only been dead for a short time. And he's just got this delicious, hammy accent. Everything about it is just incredible. His performance, as you say, is so jacked up. It's great.
It's so jacked up and it's so stylized. His performance is obviously theatrical, but the look in his eyes is so grounded. He is I don't know that this man blinks in this movie at all. Yeah. Like when he is talking to someone, he's like, you don't understand. And he never blinks. And I'm like, I wonder if he ever blinked during this production. It's enthralling watching him.
Are you aware of, there's Michael Caine famously wrote a book, or at least he has a YouTube video that passed around.
Oh,
and he thinks about blinking as a whole thing in performance. You're choosing your blink carefully, and he advises you to blink less. It's really interesting. In fact, the whole blinking thing, you could do a podcast about blinking, because there's a great editing book called In the Blink of an Eye, which I recommend to your listeners.
Yeah.
And that speaks about, if you watch a performance, if you're the editor and you're watching a performance, very often the actor will blink, and the writer will tell you that that's maybe where the edit should go, because the actor kind of knows it's the end of a thought.
Exactly. That's exactly right, Larry. I am very familiar with the Michael Caine, with that entire video series.
What did he say? He said, don't blink, or save your blink, or what does he say?
I believe he says something like blinking is a sign of being unsure, being unstable, like kind of processing or being uncomfortable, but holding a gaze is very powerful. Yes. I remember him always advising for an actor to angle their face, to use the eye that is closest, that is furthest away from camera. So you're angling toward, so you're always kind of opening your face to the camera. So use the eye that will allow you to do that when you're focusing on the other actor. And then as far as blinking, he usually advised to not blink. I do find blinking, as an actor myself, kind of, it is a tool. I was reminded of that when I was watching Colin's performance in this. And he, you know, obviously he has a one-track mind. He is trying to do something no man has ever done before, which is to not, as he says, you know, when he creates this monster, he did not create it from the dead. It never lived, and he wanted to create it. And this purpose that he has given himself in life is unwavering, and so is his eye contact with anyone around him. And it's just really enthralling to watch. Moving forward in the story, the lab where he's working, it's very grand and theatrical, but it's very grounded too because of the electricity, the sounds of the electricity popping. Yeah. Like they feel so violent and tangible. And I'm like, oh no, something's going to catch on fire.
Yeah. Like, and even the platform where the monster is and the design, I mean, once again, we haven't even talked about Karloff yet.
Yeah.
But the way the bandages, I mean, it's just the set design and the choices, let's say that, which is back to James Whale. The choices are so appealing and now they're iconic. But, you know, like the bands that wrap around the monster, I mean, maybe there are three of them. It's just also so beautiful. And by the way, In the Blink of an Eye is by Walter Murch. He's the sound designer for Apocalypse Now and The Godfather, and he was an editor and filmmaker. So I just want to shout out to him. It's a great book for filmmakers to read.
Yeah, I fully endorse that too. It's such a good book. And just to continue with how we're grounding ourselves in something, no one has ever seen any of this before. The platform, the electricity, as you said, Elizabeth, who is the fiance to Colin, is of course longing for her fiance. Like, oh no, you know, where is he? Is usually the role I'm given, which is, you know, gets a little old after a while. But poor Elizabeth, like, poor thing. She's waiting on her fiance. She's like, okay, I need to go get him. And her friend who probably has a big crush on her. He, you know, he kind of makes a pass at her before they venture off. And she's like, no. Like, no, that's sweet. Why don't you go help me find my fiance? Well, let's go together. And I'm sure he's like, oh, great. But so they travel in this pouring storm. And I was kind of amazed at the ferocity of this storm outside Henry's castle and the beautiful raked stage where he comes to this window that's overhanging over them as this rain is just crashing and pummeling down on them. And this is pre-code, so you know everybody is just drenched in freezing water. Like, no, there is no say. I'm sure people are like getting pneumonia and they're just like, deal with it. But it does feel quite violent. It feels any fire you see on screen, any electricity, any water, I mean, it's real. And what a joy to see that in the midst of CGI and just, you know, even fake blood hitting walls in films. I can't stand it now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's so tactile. And that's what I mean. It has this little bit more of a punk aesthetic than even the following one. And, you know, it's fine if people will disagree, but that's my sense of it. And I love that part of the movie because it really, you really feel the drama of he's trying to do something. Once again, talking about the universality of sort of the setup, he's trying to do something. I don't care if he's a filmmaker or he's trying to, you know, invent new code or whatever. He's obsessive. And then comes his, you know, family, his beloveds, and they're just interrupting him. And the way he's trying to negotiate, you know, excuse me, there's a storm. This is my only chance to finish my project. And you guys are here, but, you know, okay, of course, come in. The whole negotiation of that, and that you have to keep going down the stairs. And then he finally lets them into the actual room. And then he's also filled with pride. And you know, it eventually will lead to the wonderfully cliche at the time, brilliantly new moment where he says, "It's alive! It's alive!"
I was so hoping you'd do
as
it.
An audience, you know, so fucking awesome.
It's partnering the upper class societal world with this dark, dirty, dingy, dangerous world of creation, and I think
of an artist, so to speak,
No, exactly. You know, I'm reminded of Ingmar Bergman speaking about this because he was famously, you know, a difficult partner, kind of removed. His mind was constantly elsewhere. I know his children had, you know, kind of lonely childhoods without dad a lot of the time because he was constantly on set. And I'm actually not sure if he coined this phrase or if someone else did, but he wanted to be an art monster. And that's what he wanted. And I honestly have to look up that quote to properly establish it. Who said it? But I love that idea of being an art monster, because I feel that so deeply. When I kind of get into a flow state, I'm like, get away. This is like the magical time. Like this does not come just when you start to write something or edit, or when you're getting into a role. You need time. You need to nurture it.
You need a headspace. You can't just have small talk and so on. I agree. Yeah. And really, it's almost the role of, well, it's the job of the artist to create that space for themselves. And of course, you know, in an ideal world, you'd be balanced and be able to have the home life or whatever that version, you know, the friend life. But there's a certain point at which, you know what, I need this mental space. And as you point out, you can't turn on inspiration. And it is the cliche. It could come in the shower. It often does. You have the most random good ideas, or at least ideas you can hold on to at the weirdest times. And I think the job of the artist is to know when to capture that. You know, David Lynch has such wonderful, you know, he talks about
catching the big fish.
Yeah, just the idea of an idea is very special thing that, you know, yeah, catching the fish. It's so, of course, Lynch is so charming talking about art. I was about to do my imitation, but I'll leave it be. I can't quite call it up when I want, but I love David's voice and his whole soothing insanity. But monster, according to my parents, was my first word. Can you believe that?
Monster was?
Can you believe it? I don't know if it's apocryphal, but I love that. If it's true, good on me.
No, that's reality. I'm going to believe that's real. Oh, I love that, Larry.
I love it too. I want it on my Wikipedia.
If anyone is writing for Wikipedia or knows how to edit, please add that to Larry.
Jordan will know. I'll just tell AI to do it.
That's right. Whatever AI monster is listening right now, please update Larry's Wikipedia. Thank you. Well, back to the tactile monster instead of an AI monster. I do have to say, he has birthed his creature, right? It comes down as if from the heavens. And right before that, he says this line, and I have to read it because it's just so great. That body is not dead. It has never lived. I created it. I made it with my own hands, with bodies I took from the gallows. And I love that he makes this so clear. And this is when I really noticed him not blinking. because he is very clear about this. He's like, no, I'm not bringing back the dead. That is almost beneath him. He is creating something entirely new, which is in a way what this film did itself. It is very metaphorical of this entire film, because this is the first time people are seeing this story really brought to life in a film. And it is not something rehashed. It's not a franchise. It's not, you know, a repeated story. This is brand new. And when the monster comes down, like you did such a great rendition of, it's alive. Now I know what it feels like to be God. And, you know, it's so interesting. The studio actually made the director put another huge thunderclap over that last line when he says, now I know what it feels like to be God. They thought that was so blasphemous, even in pre-code film, that they felt that they could not push this very shocking film to audiences, not because of the monster, but because of that line. And later it was kind of put back in so you can hear the word God and the thunder, but the original audio has never been fully brought back. And so I just find that so interesting.
Another thing we didn't actually mention is that, you know, you, assuming you're watching the original cut or whatever they're now playing on Blu-ray or whatever's going on, there's the whole preamble by Carl Laemmle, the producer, that says, this story may shock you, it may horrify you, and you've been warned. And so they actually added that, not to up the ante, which is sort of its role now, to sort of make you, it's almost like Alfred Hitchcock Presents, you know, where there's a little preamble to warm you up. But it was truly to warn audience members, because they did feel they had created something so shocking. Anyway, that's a fun little treat. And the whole idea that Carl Laemmle, you know, producers were so essential in those days, as they still are in showbiz. Mm. And these giants of cinema, Carl Laemmle made Dracula and then this. And decades later, I was always touched to show my indie films at the Laemmle theaters in Los Angeles. And it was a descendant of Carl Laemmle that would present Habit and I think Depraved. And so it felt like this really, whatever outsider status in showbiz I have, I felt this deep connection to this real history of these monster makers from the 30s.
Yeah. Well, and my first feature, Alone With You, played in a Laemmle theater as well in LA. And it's just, yeah, you feel like a small square or a little piece of like the quilt that makes up this lineage of Hollywood and movies.
We'll go to Boris.
Poor Boris. He's just been sitting there on the table, just waiting for us to talk about him.
Instacart makes grocery shopping easier. And just because you're not doing the shopping yourself doesn't mean you don't care how it's done. With Instacart Shopper Notes, you can get particular about what you want right in the app. Like rotisserie chicken that's extra crispy, steak with marbling the Romans would have loved, and lettuce you'd actually pick yourself. Just leave a note for your shopper so they can get it right for you without having to ask. That way, you can get groceries just how you like. Download the Instacart app and shop today.
The Bleacher Report app is your destination for sports. Right now, the NBA is heating up, March Madness is here, and MLB is almost back. Every day there's a new headline, a new highlight, a new moment you've got to see for yourself. That's why I stay locked in with the Bleacher Report app. For me, it's about staying connected to my sports. I can follow the teams I care about, get real-time scores, breaking news, and highlights all in one place. Download the Bleacher Report app today so you never miss a moment.
So when we see him, just the design of him, first of all, is just shocking. He's got, like you said, the flat top. He's got these bolts in his neck. He has a bit of a Neanderthal kind of brow. It's kind of overhanging, which really works so beautifully with this directional lighting. And I read somewhere that he actually demanded to get shoes that were like 10 or 15 pounds each, like the soles of them. Is that right?
Yeah, they were shoes worn by cement layers. Everything about the costume is so fantastic. And I always like the sort of bendy back legs. I don't know. Well, I think it's important. So Karloff was bow-legged. Karloff, the physical creature that is Boris Karloff, was really why the monster makeup works so well. He has incredible bone structure. He has these beautiful, veiny arms. So in other words, I think when James Whale saw him in the commissary, at least as the story goes, he saw this physical creature and could maybe impose in his mind the makeup. And he realized this was an amazing canvas to start with. Mm. And so Karloff requested those boots, which I don't quite understand how it works, but they were used by cement layers. And they were really heavy. And then the flat top came from Jack Pierce. And it was, he looked at many ways that you might do a brain transplant. And he decided that the easiest way would be just to cut the skull and then you'd flap the skin back over and you wouldn't bother. It doesn't make total sense, but it's wonderful that he came up with it. And then the bolts were because of the electricity. And then Karloff had a bridge in his mouth and they took that out, which made his cheeks more gaunt. Mm. It's fun because, you know, people are very sloppy, but when you become a film nerd, you start to know these things. Like there's different pictures of the monster and the makeup changed over time. And there's some where these huge latches on the top of the head. And that's just an early makeup test. And then that was rejected. But every now and again, it'll still show up in a picture as if it was used. So all of that, it was obviously fetishized. The other thing that's funny is that in order to make him look incredibly pale, they chose to color him green. Mm. And that's why the cliche of the cartoon is that he's green. But that was never anybody's theory, that the monster was green. Now, listen, I'm going to just riff yet again on another of the greatest movies ever made. In 1932, Mamoulian made Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Mm-hmm. And what's cool is that there's a scene which is not only a trick mirror scene, which is a cool thing, but it's also a makeup thing. So Frederick March played the monster. He's the only guy that ever got an Oscar for a monster until Silence of the Lambs, technically. But he had different colored makeup that would emphasize the Mr. Hyde look. And by changing the lighting, the makeup would reveal itself in a tape. And then, so that was there again, they're using color to trick the black and white film to their ends. And so that's a sort of a classic trick in that film, which, as I say, I highly recommend for any old-timey monster fans, because that's a beautiful creature and a great makeup and a great telling of that story.
No, I love that clip. And if anyone hasn't seen that film, you can go on YouTube and see kind of just that one clip. It's really phenomenal. And again, we're just looking back to this actual craft before computers came and painted over all of this. I you know, this is all in camera. Nothing was done separately. It's just beautiful human ingenuity and craft going into these things. And so we have this monster. So, you know, it's interesting as the monster becomes a proper character in this film, because we know he has an abnormal brain, but he seems kind of gentle and like afraid of being alive. He seems to be trying to get his footing. And I feel like it's not until the fire, which reckons back to Mary Shelley's title, The Modern Prometheus.
All right.
You know, when Fritz shows fire to the monster, kind of warning him to behave, That's the first time that we really see the monster riled up, is when he's threatened. And so it's interesting that he has a, quote, abnormal brain. I wonder if he would, you know, it's the nature-nurture thing. Would he have been okay if he was never threatened, kind of thing? It makes me feel really sad for the monster, because we learn that he's really terrified of fire, which plays in later. But do you think this is a story of like nature and nurture, or how does that abnormal brain and the treatment of him, what's more responsible for how this ends up going?
Well, you're sort of touching all my buttons, because I have made a Frankenstein movie. It's called Depraved. And I
would say
that is the theme, is nature and nurture. And also, where does the innocence get corrupted? And my premise, I think my answer is just growing up and learning that the world is unfair is where it gets corrupted. And your response to that, your response is sort of who you become and who you are. And unfortunately, in the telling of a Frankenstein story, very often you become violent, the monster, you know, lashing out at life's injustices and feeling ignored or lonely and all of this. Anyway, that's how I've interpreted the themes, but you're right. It is the Frankenstein story. And it's important to sort of take note of that dynamic. It's not in my movie. I have my other concerns, but I'm saying that it's Fritz and whatever Fritz's problems are that he decides to go after this relative innocent. But, you know, if you really wanted to get Freudian, is Fritz feeling, you know, being replaced as the object of people's interest? I don't know. It's a funny thing, but at its fundamental, Fritz taunts the monster, maybe because he feels he can dominate the monster, because the monster is somewhat helpless, especially his first scene. As you say, he's literally trying to grasp the sunlight, and it's a very sweet, innocent gesture that just has to do with I'm alive and I'm this is glorious and there's light and I'm just happy to be here. So that is what is corrupted, literally innocence. So it's so profound. And once again, sorry for this refrain, but it's all in this extremely simple, spare telling. The thing I just described is just one sequence, and then that sort of shows he's innocent. And then shortly thereafter, you see him getting prodded with the fire by Fritz. And then shortly thereafter, they come in and there's a shadow depicting that Fritz has been hung by the monster. And the monster, well, you saw the movie recently. What? He leaves. How does he leave?
I just wanted to comment just on what you said about Fritz. I also think he's kind of the lowest on the totem pole as far as any of this world. And I think he sees he has been abused clearly and made to, you know, he's doing the dirty work, having to climb up to the gallows. He's just kind of the worker.
A class thing. Because like you say, all these buffoons. One thing we don't want to talk too much about is the father of Colin Clive. It's sort of like it's a slightly comedic character, and the studio insisted that he do the coda, so he's sort of annoyingly in the movie. But in any case, this is clearly a wealthy family, as you say, the Frankensteins, and Fritz is quite literally the servant. And I think you're right. It's kind of a class thing. And he feels encroached upon by this monster who's going to become the object of everybody's interest.
Become the object, yes. But also he is not technically fully human. And it is the first time that Fritz might feel superior to anyone.
Yes.
And that's chilling too, you know, when you're kind of constantly shoved down by the unfair world by just growing up. Yeah. When you know, bullied people can make bullies sometimes. And
of course,
it's that idea of victims make other victims. And maybe Fritz sees the opportunity to feel a bit godlike or to feel a bit more powerful than he's ever been able to feel, not by climbing up, but kicking down, you know?
Yeah, what's the expression? You know, you kick the dog, your boss yells at you, and then you go and kick the dog. Exactly. That's 100% what's going on. And it is just a comment on human nature. Once again, it's a metaphor. The hunchback feels superior to the dead guy.
Your question. So Fritz is hung, and then they come in. There's a struggle with the monster. They give him a shot in his arm, I think. It's a very tight shot, and he passes out. So then he is strapped to the table again, and
the hand coming up and grabbing the guy on the neck.
Yes. So Henry, I think Henry's gone, and his mentor, I can't remember his name, the Burgermaster, is that him?
Burgermaster.
This is all in Germany, with just
fake Germany.
A grab bag of accents. But so he's working on the monster who's passed out, who's strapped to the table again. But we see the monster wake up, and his hand slowly rises behind him, and he grabs him from the back of the throat, and he is killed, this man, and then is able to escape. So obviously Henry and Elizabeth have had to steal away because they got to get married. And she was like, honey, you did your thing. You made the man. Can we please go get married now? And he's like, yes, okay. You know, I've made, thank you for giving me my art studio space, honey. And he's like, yes, okay, I will go give you your wedding. And clearly this is a wealthy family. We then enter real society. This is the first time we go. So we've started in a graveyard. We're in this dank lab. And then we go into this beautiful town that's like a town square, and it's idyllic and dancing children and la la la. And Elizabeth is getting ready for her wedding in the longest veil and train I have ever seen. She's wearing like many, many bed sheets of clothing here. Just in this cascading white gown. Henry's getting ready for the wedding, but we have obviously this ominous sense of foreboding because we know the monster is loose and what's going to happen. So we are moving through the town square during this joyous day. We're moving past pedestrians, background, day players, who are simply living their lives and like, oh, yes, over here, and la, 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 the children. Oh, do you want some bread? Yes. And you know, there's people eating outside. And we get this lovely sense of movement through this town. And then we cut to a farmer leaving his little girl, little Maria. She is playing with her cat, and she has gone by the water to kind of play alone because her dad has to work. And she's sitting there picking flowers, and the monster comes out of the bushes and sees her. And when he sits by the water with her, the camera moves toward them again. And it's kind of the first time I really noticed the camera moving finally, because we're usually pretty still in the film. And then he sits there with her. And Larry, why don't you paint the picture of this scene? Because it's just so moving in so many ways.
Well, so I believe he kneels, which is kind of sweet. So he comes down to her level, and she's sitting there, and she grabs some daisies. And I can't remember what she says, but she basically says we can make them into boats. And she tosses them. So you have the two shot that I think you're right was moved in. And then I think we have singles on each of them.
Yeah.
But the storyline is that he wants to play with her, and she's very inviting. For one thing, that obviously the true beauty is that the child does not recoil at his image, which is, you know, this flat top we've been describing this whole time. So she throws her flowers in, and it's very pleasant. And he throws his in, and everybody's having a good time. And then he runs out of flowers. And he thinks, well, I have to keep playing this game. So he picks her up, and he throws her into the water. And the way they stage it is that she goes into the water behind him. So the camera's looking out into the lake, and she splashes behind him. So in terms of the tastefulness or the code or whatever's going on, you don't see her actually land in the water. You just see the splash. And then he gets confused, and then she's not there in a subsequent shot. So that's the end of her. He runs away confused. So again, his first, well, this is now his second violent act. The first one was out of anger, presumably. This one is completely innocent and just out of, he had that abnormal brain. He didn't know about the flowers and the boats. So that's the iconic scene, and it's been trimmed in different ways. And I don't know the one that one might watch now, whether it's the full version, but for a long time it was cut down.
Yeah, the version that I saw, well, and to go back to what you were saying, he was defending himself. The monster was defending himself from Fritz, I think.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
This act is totally innocent because he thinks this is a game.
Yes, you're absolutely.
Yeah, so I do still think this is quite innocent. And the version that I saw, which is on the Internet Archive, actually, which I kind of trust more than kind of people trying to make a buck doing another, you know, release, unless it's like Criterion or something. But it the version that I saw her hit the water. And there was no struggle, but then he walked away from the water. And I did did see this piece of trivia. This little actress on set, they had to do this take so many times. And the director felt, he felt so bad for this little girl. Marilyn Harris is her name, the little actress. And she was kind of fine. The water was freezing. They were just like, okay, I'm so sorry. James Whale was like, I'm so sorry. We have to do this one more time. Are you okay? Like, obviously she had to dry off and she had to get ready every single time. And he was like, what's your favorite food? I will give you your favorite food if you will do this take one more time. And her favorite food was a dozen hard-boiled eggs.
Oh, my God.
And so he gave her 2 dozen hard-boiled eggs for doing this take like one more time. So she really got her protein, that girl.
Never forget that. That's incredible.
It's just so funny to me. So, yeah, she goes in and the monster just walks away. And then we immediately cut back to the beautiful revelry that's happening on the day of this wedding. And we're like, oh no, because we know the farmer is there working.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
when is this, you know, when is the shoe going to drop? And then we have this gorgeous take. And again, I talk about the camera movement because we've already traveled through this town square and the joyous revelry that's happening. And then the farmer off screen finds his daughter and enters this town square. And instead of going through the town square to see all of this joy, we lead him, basically watching him enter this town square and walk through. And behind him, it just gave me chills watching it.
Yeah.
People, they're reveling and then they look over and they stand up and everything starts to go quiet as he passes people with the body of his dead daughter hanging in his arms. And it is the most chilling, long take that we've already, thank God, he already established this beautiful movement through the town square. So now that we're tracking backward, it is just such a stark, it's so chilling and so emotional. I was really taken by watching that again. It's so heartbreaking and simple.
Very simple. This is the thing about that movie. Just devastating. And so now you realize the monster is cooked because he'll never be able to explain his side of the story. And, you know, obviously emotions are going in every direction. This is the power of this movie.
Then we go into this nightmarish nighttime scene, right? They're told about the death of this girl, and Henry immediately asks, you know, where is the monster? And the monster's been seen. And so now come the hounds, and now come the fire. And it turns into this hellish nighttime landscape. Again, you know, we start in the graveyard in this stark darkness, and we're back there again. And the monster flees to this windmill that is just the most, it is reminiscent of, honestly, it reminds me of Wicker Man, transpires here. The monster flees into this windmill. Henry gets there before he, before the masses come to tear the monster apart. And he's basically manhandled by the monster up into this windmill, high, high up. And everyone comes, the town comes with fire and dogs, and they start to burn the windmill. And the monster drops Henry out of the window of this windmill, and he hits one of the spokes of the windmill going down.
Yeah.
Which,
it's a very bad dummy.
Yeah. I mean, it is a bad dummy.
But it's very gruesome, the idea that he not only thrown out the window, but he lands on one of the sails or whatever they're called. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I think basically because of the ending, he survived. So maybe it stopped his fall before he would have properly died, but I'm not totally sure. But it it's brutal. But Larry, I was so taken by the chilling imagery of this, because as the windmill was still going, the spokes of it were still moving, and they're on fire. The trail of smoke made this almost look like a swastika to me.
Interesting.
And yeah. And obviously this is prior to World War II, but it's mm-hmm. it's just, you know, and maybe I'm seeing that in hindsight, but it was just such a chilling image to me, seeing this from afar, and the anger and just the violence of this crowd. It was just, it really was shocking in kind of a bigger way as well. So that this scene is just devastating. So,
well, so many things come to mind, but yeah, this is also, we keep saying this is the first, but I believe this is the first angry mob, which also becomes a cliche, but it's still so relevant if you think about the angry mobs through history. And I think it's fair. I mean, I don't think it was purposeful, but the thing is things do evoke things. And even if, you know, swastikas came later, there's, you know, there's the angular design and there's the sense of menace. Mm-hmm. And so maybe, well, all I'm saying is that, you know, that's what's remarkable about horror is it evokes the darkness that we live with, and it comes up in different ways. And I don't know what's anticipating what, but, you know, obviously the Nazis used images of power and Riefenstahl, you know, certain cinematic tropes. So I don't know. There's always a dialogue. I think that's what we've been saying between history and genuine fear, and then these movies, which capture it in one way or another.
Yeah. Absolutely. And yeah, the angry mob, you're right. It extends into cinema beyond this. Obviously, we see it in so many genre films and other films as well. It's,
I don't know if you saw that wonderful picture, January 6th. It was a real nail biter. Anyway, that was an angry mob, for example. In other words, unfortunately, it does keep happening, and it comes out of just hot tempers and when people abandon their, I mean, look, obviously, as we've said, that it's set up in this movie that they truly believe this monster's on the rampage. Mm-hmm. One thing that's funny about your account of the movie, and I feel like we are running out of time, but yeah, there's the other iconic scene, and it's only interesting because these things are in the book in some much more literary way. But the monster is seen outside the window to the bride, Henry's bride, preparing for the wedding. And it's an amazing confrontation, one of the great couple of cuts in the movie, when he approaches her and he's going to exact revenge. And in the book, he does kill the relatives of, well, don't get me started, Victor is the name of the monster.
I know.
Book. So on it goes. It's all, I even have jokes about this in my own film, Depraved. I'm like, now wait, what's the guy's name? So, but anyway, this is a great confrontation too. You have the classic scene of a monster looking in a window from outside while the innocent is inside, or the unknowing, the bride, and she's in that fantastic train you described. And then he does come in. I think it's only done with a cut. You never see him climbing. And then he's in there, and it's just this very brief stride sideways towards her, and then two close-ups, and she does that scream that's so iconic when you put your hand up and go, ah!
Yeah.
Anyway, and then I believe they cut outside and everybody's like, what just happened? Mm. And then show her draped on the bed and the monster got getting away. So you realize, I also wanted to just say,
yeah,
I think Henry does die in the original script and the original intention. And when I made a joke about the silly father, they added that coda, and in order to assure the audience that Colin Clive survived, but that was not the original intention of the filmmaker.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah, because, I mean, to talk about the ending, you're exactly. I was watching it and we don't see Henry after this massive scene. We just see him fall. And then we're back in the Frankenstein manor with the father, surrounded by like 10 beautiful maid girls who are all just like giggling around him. And he asks them to bring, I think it's wine or brandy or something, to the door, that Henry is like recovering in the room, and he opens the door, and we vaguely see a man's figure kind of sitting up in bed, but we don't see anything specific. And the father goes in to give him this drink, but he looks at him and he shuts the door and he's like, I think he says something like, I'll drink it. He doesn't need this alcohol. And then his final line, it just feels so tacked on because all the women are just like, oh my, you crazy man. And he raises the glass and he says, here's to a son for the House of Frankenstein. And that's like the last line of the film. And it feels so odd after everything we've just seen is like, but he'll have a son now because he survived.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. As a kid, I feel like I edited these movies in my mind. And not that I was feasting for tragedy, but in my mind, the monster killed the bride and then Colin Clive was killed at the end and so on and so on. In other words, I just almost had to ignore certain of these. I'd never liked that goofy ending and it just bugged me. So I in my mind, I cut it out.
Honestly, me too. We can agree.
We'll speak no more of it.
That's right. The ending and, that shall not be named.
Yeah, it shall not. He who shall not be named. I do love the bad stuffed dummy though landing on that windmill blade. So that is the ending that's in my mind. And then poor Boris getting squished by that beam is also so iconic because he's just pinned down. And that's it. Just terribly sad.
Well, Larry, I have taken up so much of your time. Thank you so much for sharing this perfect Tower film with me. Honestly, I do feel like it does burn down all preconceptions of films that came before this. And even the ending of it with the windmill on fire, in a way, is a kind of Tower in and of itself, burning to the ground. And it's just, what a delight to talk to a modern master of horror and monster films about such a foundational film for you. So thank you so much for coming on, Larry.
Oh, I had a blast. And I do like drawing attention to some of these, you know, these foundational pictures, you know, everything that follows. There's many great Frankenstein movies and there's some bad ones, but this one started a trend and the monster changed over time. And became more and more scary. And that's the one that lived in my mind. But it's fun to see how nuanced he was in the beginning, just truly a sad, misunderstood creature, which is something I think we can all relate to. And that's the power of horror cinema.
I think that's a perfect place to end. amazing. Well, thank you again, Larry.
Thanks for having me on, Emily. I'll see you soon, I hope.
The Tower is a Glass Eye Picks production. The show is created and hosted by me, Emily Bennett. The show is produced by Jordan Goss-Pure. Technical advisor is Justin Brooks. Sound engineering by Mark Bush. Original music for The Tower was composed by Graham Resnick. Additional music provided by Epidemic Sound. Art by Stake Mountain. See you next time.
The Bleacher Report app is your destination for sports. Right now, the NBA is heating up, March Madness is here, and MLB is almost back. Every day there's a new headline, a new highlight, a new moment you've got to see for yourself. That's why I stay locked in with the Bleacher Report app. For me, it's about staying connected to my sports. I can follow the teams I care about, get real-time scores, breaking news, and highlights all in one place. Download the Bleacher Report app today so you never miss a moment.